Okay, how's the sound? Can you hear me all right? Thank you. All right, so we're going to have a little guided metta practice, loving kindness practice during this session. And I'll just say a few words about metta for anyone who's not familiar. I'm probably going to share a few stories as well, just to kind of bring in the metta in various ways. And then Vance will do a similar session tomorrow as well. So I was in the IMS staff library 2.5 years ago on a similar type of retreat. And I found this manual of Abhidhamma, which is a ancient Buddhist text. I looked up the word metta in this pretty old manual, and it said it's derived from the word meaning to soften, to love, the word metta in Pali. And according to the Sanskrit of Maitri, it's state of a friend, that which softens the mind or friendly disposition, that's metta. And it goes on, goodwill, benevolence, loving kindness are suggested as the best renderings. The direct enemy of metta is hatred or ill will. Metta embraces all beings without exception. The culmination of metta is the identification of oneself with all beings. And then finally, metta is the sincere wish for the good and welfare of all. It discards ill will. Sometimes it's literally translated as non-ill will, which I kind of like that rendering. Another good one is just goodwill, having goodwill towards others. But non-ill will feels like at least a reachable bar in some cases. So the Dalai Lama once said, we can let the circumstances of our lives harden us so that we become increasingly resentful and afraid, or we can let them soften us and make us kinder. You always have the choice. I love that. And Ajahn Sumedho, who's a senior Theravada monk in the Thai forest, Ajahn Chah, Thai forest lineage, he said, our practice is not to follow the heart, it is to train the heart. So metta practice is a way that we actively train the heart. And then Joseph Goldstein, co-founder of IMS, said, often we hear the adage, follow your heart. But having practiced and looked at all the things that have arisen in my heart, I've seen that while some things were fine and beautiful, many were not so noble. The heart is not only driven by love, kindness, and compassion. It's also driven by desire, greed, and anger. We need to train the heart, not simply follow it. And then you might have heard this one before. It's a W.H. Auden, the poet, quote, love your crooked neighbor with all your crooked heart. That's another one of my favorites. And there's a poem that I've always found really moving by Naomi Shihab Nye called Kindness. You may have heard this before too, but it still feels worth reading. She wrote, before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved. Sorry. All this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore, only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to gaze at bread, only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say it is I you have been looking for, and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. So there's a story that I like to read too that I've always found pretty touching. It's you may have heard of Father Gregory Boyle. He started Homeboy Industries in Los Angeles, and he works with gangs in that part of the world. And basically, Homeboy Industries employs a lot of former gang members and helps kind of support them in a non-gang life. And it's pretty amazing work. I've seen him speak once, and he's really incredible, you know, carrier of compassion. So here's a story that he wrote in a book called Barking to the Choir. There's a couple films about him, and he has multiple books. Tattoos on the Heart is the first and most famous of the books. So he wrote, at the turn of the century, I am diagnosed with leukemia. He's okay now, by the way. And rushed into chemotherapy. I tolerate it all reasonably well. I tell a friend that on any given day during chemo, however, I feel like one or more of the seven dwarfs. I may be grumpy, dopey, or sleepy. Occasionally, I'll even be one of their cousins, gassy, poopy, or queasy. In the midst of my treatments, I get a call that Bird has been in a very serious car accident. Bird, now in his 20s, was one of the most truly knuckleheaded gang members I have ever known. For a long time, he was impervious to all offers of help. He loved smoking cools, PCP, shooting at enemies, and being provocative at every turn. I always gave him credit, lots of credit, for a goodly portion of my white hair. I did get him a job early on, but he got shot and never returned to work. Though fully recovered, he'd thrown in the towel. But the last couple of years, Bird has turned things around, working and becoming a dedicated husband and father of two. Recovery has become part of the air he breathes. I've often seen him at Homeboy, where he regularly attends 12-step meetings. We've been on the battlefield together, G, he says during one of his visits. And indeed, we have. Now, in between chemo sessions, I slip over to the ICU at General Hospital to visit him. Even before the cancer, I was not a stranger to hospital horrors. Nothing surprises or startles me much anymore, having seen human bodies rearranged every which way. But seeing Bird takes my breath away. Virtually every bone in his body is broken. Both his legs are suspended and in casts, held together by an amazing array of pins. He is immobile and intubated, unable to speak, with IVs everywhere. I've never seen a body so devastated and dismantled as the one lying before me. His eyes look startled when he sees me. They bloom and come alive. There's no panic in them, only a steady sense, the ground of all being. His gaze locks onto mine, my eyes glisten. I go on and on about how he'll make it, how much we all love him, etc. The things you say. I just keep talking, trying to detail the discomfort and anguish that so fill me as I stand there. Oh, derail the discomfort and anguish that so fill me as I stand there at his bedside. I ask to say a prayer over him, and I do so, placing my hand on his forehead and anointing him with oil used for the sacrament of the sick. When I'm done, he gestures barely with his right hand, indicating his desire to write something. A few of the fingers in his right hand seem to be the only operative bones in this man's body. I grab a small pad of paper on a nearby table and hand him my pen. After much labor, Bird writes this. "But you, G, how are you doing?" Both U's are capitalized. I begin to cry. I hold my face in my hands, powerless in the presence of such soaring generosity. Suddenly the alarm on a machine goes off. I ask what it means. "I'm going to self-destruct," he writes. Then he makes blowing up gestures as best he can, rescuing me, I suppose, from this overwhelming emotional fullness in which I find myself. As I leave, I say, "Well, all I know is, I sure love you a lot, Philip," I say, using his given name. He makes one last panicky wave for pen and paper. "I love you more," he writes. The "more" is capitalized. So I just found that to be a touching story. We'll get into the practice in a minute. Just have one last little thing that I thought I would share that I found kind of interesting. It's an article by Rebecca Giggs from The Atlantic, the magazine, from November 2019. She wrote, "You may be surprised to learn that cows not only recognize one another as individuals, but they have friends they prefer. Indeed, it turns out that cows are especially interested in and affectionate toward particular other cows. A kind of sisterhood is thought to feature in their social lives. What is friendship in the case of a cow? Cow friendship, researchers now believe, is expressed foremost in grazing and licking. A study of a commercial herd in the United Kingdom found that put to pasture, more than half of the animals spent time eating and resting alongside a specific individual. Separated from the larger group, cows that were paired with their favored friend maintained lower heart rates and did not stamp, toss their heads, pace, or sway as much as cows paired with individuals they'd shown no partiality toward. In short, they seemed less agitated. A different study suggested that cows were able to recognize others they knew in real life from photographs, which they then ran toward. Surprisingly, the camaraderie between cows and people also appears to affect bovine productivity and perhaps contentment. A 2009 survey of more than 500 British dairy farmers revealed that cows that had been given names produced 258 more liters of milk than did cows who went unnamed and thus unrecognized as individuals. Which I think is touching. So this article prompted a letter from somebody in High Falls, New York, who wrote, "Thank you for the article on cow friendships. I'm lucky enough to work at a farmed animal sanctuary where we have seen incredible and complex relationships develop over the years. Kaylee and Maybell are two cows that live at Woodstock Farm Sanctuary. They are best friends, standing by each other, grooming each other, checking in when one of them is not feeling well. They have even become co-parents of two calves that we rescued from the dairy industry. If they were to lose each other, they'd be heartbroken. So it's all a little mysterious in a way, the movings of the heart, even with cows. And, you know, we, not just even, cows are pretty amazing, but we won't get into that any further than that. I remember on my first retreat that I did, it was a men's retreat, 5-day men's retreat, and I would say at that point my heart was pretty protected. Pretty protected. There was a bit of a wall around the heart, and I went on this retreat because Jack Kornfield was teaching it, and he was like the only teacher I knew about at the time, really. And so I was excited. And then he got sick, even though it was a short retreat, but he couldn't teach for a lot of it. And one of the other teachers, Robert Hall, kind of took over. And I didn't know much about him. But I, you know, grew to think he was a great being to be on retreat with. But at the end of the retreat, you know, it's close to 100 men. And he said, okay, on the last day of the retreat, I want a hug from everybody on this retreat. So he stood like in the front of the hall and had us line up, and everybody was going to come up and give him a hug. And like I said, I was not, I had like kind of a closed heart, and I thought, I don't really want to hug this guy. I mean, I wouldn't say that, but it was like my first reaction. But then everybody else lines up, and I felt like, well, I kind of have to hug him. It'll look bad if I don't go through this hug thing. So I get in line and, you know, wait for a long time and watch him hug all these other people. And then finally, it gets to be my turn, and I move towards him to receive the hug. And instead of hugging me, he stops me with his hand. He puts his hand on my chest, kind of like stops me. It's like he totally read the situation perfectly. But he just left his hand on my heart for a minute. And I don't remember if he said anything, but it was like then after he did that, I really wanted to hug him. And it was really fascinating. And then I got a real hug and then went away, and I thought, that was amazing. What just happened? And to this day, I can't say I know what happened, but it definitely kind of melted my heart. I will say it was like the beginning of something that felt like an ongoing heart opening for the next few years, or continuing, I'm sure. But So I guess I mentioned that because somebody recently asked me after a metta talk, like, is this, when we say heart, are we talking physical heart or something else? Or what are we talking about? And it's hard to actually answer that. But we're finding out that when, you know, people can literally die of heartbreak. And I won't go into much more than that, but that's been happening in the news. I've been reading that. So who knows? But meanwhile, I think it's important to train the heart, which is why we're here. And of course, Sharon Salzberg has really, one of the other co-founders of IMS, has really taken this on and offered this beautifully for decades now. So I'll just quote her a little bit. She says, "The practice of loving kindness is about cultivating love as a transformative strength, enabling us to feel love that is not attached to the illusion of people, including ourselves, being static, frozen, disconnected. As a result, loving kindness challenges those states that tend to arise when we think of ourselves as isolated from everyone else. Fear, a sense of deficiency, alienation, loneliness. This practice forcefully penetrates these states, and it begins, in fact, with befriending, rather than making an enemy out of ourselves." So it's about befriending ourselves, which I think is, you know, a beautiful way to look at it. And it's, as we know, it's not always that easy to love ourselves, and somehow here in the West, people seem to struggle with it more than than, at least according to the stories I've heard, people in other parts of the world. The Dalai Lama didn't understand the concept of self-hatred, self-loathing, when somebody tried to explain it to him the first time. So the practice is about sending, you know, these phrases to others and to ourselves and to ultimately to all beings. So I guess we should do the practice while we still have time. So go ahead and sit comfortably. You can be a little more relaxed, perhaps, you know, like sit in a slightly more relaxed posture, perhaps, than the formal sitting practice. And I'll give you the phrases in a minute. And you can use your own phrases. The phrases are up to you, ultimately, and you can be creative with it. But there's some traditional phrases that I'll offer to start. And you can close your eyes or not, depending on what feels right to you. But before we begin, let's just sit and breathe for a couple minutes here and just kind of let some of the stories and the poem settle a little. Just feeling the body here, supported by the earth. Just the miracle of this breath that gives us continued life. And this heart that beats to continue pumping the blood that keeps us alive. And so we'll repeat the phrases. And try to have some space between the phrases. We're not trying to create any kind of special feeling here as when we get into this. So don't worry about whether it works or doesn't work. That's not up to us. We just do the best we can. We're matching our intention with the practice and just letting it go where it goes. The important thing is to have a full, wholehearted presence behind each phrase. It's, in a way, it's a practice of generosity, giving ourselves a gift of loving attention, especially when we're saying the phrases to ourselves. So we start with a benefactor. That's the first category. We talk about it in terms of categories. A benefactor is someone who they may or may not know us individually, but we've benefited from them in some way that we're very grateful for. It could be a teacher, parent, mentor, donor, some kind of supporter. So you come up with just one person who it would be easy to send well wishes to, and picture them in your mind. You can picture them almost like they're sitting in front of you with a benevolent smile on their face. And then you can send them these phrases. May you be happy and peaceful. May you be healthy and strong. May you be safe and protected from harm. May you live with ease and well-being. And we just spent a few minutes sending these phrases. May you be happy and peaceful. May you be healthy and strong. May you be safe and protected from harm. May you live with ease and well-being. If we get distracted, we just try to come back, picture them sitting there again, send the phrases. May you be happy and peaceful. May you be healthy and strong. May you be safe and protected from harm. May you live with ease and well-being. Or again, you're welcome to modify the phrases as well. And finishing up with the benefactor. Now we're going to turn it around onto ourselves, the befriending ourselves aspect. And we might imagine, just as this person that we just sent phrases to, the benefactor might wish us to be happy and peaceful. Can we offer that to ourselves? And if it's difficult to do it for our adult self, sometimes it's suggested you could send it to yourself as a, say, 5 years old, something like that. So it's okay to be creative in that way. So just, you know, imagining, seeing yourself as your benefactor or somebody who really cares about you might see you, only wanting what's best for you in your life, and bringing the phrases to mind, may I be happy and peaceful. May I be healthy and strong. May I be safe and protected from harm. May I live with ease and well-being. May I be happy and peaceful. May I be healthy and strong. May I be safe and protected from harm. May I live with ease and well-being. May I be happy and peaceful. May I be healthy and strong. May I be safe and protected from harm. May I live with ease and well-being. So just take a few moments to continue to send yourself these phrases or phrases you prefer to use. tomorrow, Vance will introduce some additional categories. But I also like to end, and this may be aspirational for many of us, but end with sending the phrases out to all beings, which is kind of the ultimate. We're radiating kindness out throughout the entire world. It's kind of the ultimate goal here, or aim of the practice. So may all beings be happy and peaceful. May all beings be healthy and strong. May all beings be safe and protected from harm. May all beings live with ease and well-being. I have to leave in about 5 minutes, but wanted to just open it up to see if there were any sort of burning questions about anything that I just, you know, this practice in particular. Just give that opportunity so that we just to check in with you, see if anybody had any questions. Yes, please. Yeah, I wish them. I don't know that we got the microphones fixed, but so you're saying about yesterday's teaching that Vance offered on the refuges in particular. But then once we learn about things like how everything is impermanent and constantly changing, how do we then go back to our normally scheduled lives and jobs and family and that, and instead of just becoming a saint or something? Well, I've found it very helpful in my regular life to have these wisdom teachings kind of in my understanding as I face life. You know, I don't know. I mean, certainly with things like deaths in the family, things, it's been very helpful to sort of had these teachings and even done contemplation of death and practices like that. And but for example, I worked in the corporate world and there were a lot of layoffs, you know, and there was a point where, and I didn't have this kind of practice yet. I had some interest in it and some knowledge, but not really an embodied knowledge. But I remember my team had been called into a room and said, yeah, there have been a lot of layoffs, but we don't want anybody here to panic. Nobody in this room is going to get laid off for the rest of this year. So we're all like, whew, okay, we still have a job. Well, like a month later, I can't remember exactly, but I'm coming to work, I'm in the hallway, and my boss sees me, and he says, oh, Walt, hey, glad that I ran into you. I want to talk to you. Can you walk with me for a minute? Actually, can we go into this, step in this office for a minute? And he said it so jovially that I thought, oh, he's going to give me some great new project, right? And he basically pulls me in the office, closes the door, and says, I'm sorry to tell you, I'm going to have to lay you off. You know, it just completely shocked me because I thought I was, you know, good at the time. Wasn't going to be laid off. But I didn't have those. You know, I think that it would have helped me to realize everything is constantly changing. I should have known this could have happened, in that case, I was actually really shocked. It took me a couple of weeks to kind of get it together a little bit. But so I think that what ultimately we're cultivating, you know, I didn't go into the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes. The metta is the first of four Brahma Viharas. It's loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy or mudita, karuna for compassion, and then the last one is upekkha, equanimity. And we're cultivating equanimity as well, so that we're not thrown by these worldly winds that we're constantly forced to endure out in the world. And so the equanimity, it's balance of mind. That's really, in a way, what we're cultivating here as well. I mean, open-heartedness, but also balance of mind, because the world is challenging. And we do have to make a living, or unless we have, you know, other means. So it's just a reality, you know. We have to accept causes and conditions in our life as well. So I don't know if that's kind of how I see it. But the equanimity might be a way to look at it, to remember to cultivate that in addition to the loving kindness. Thank you. Unfortunately, I have to go. I have to lead a final Zoom class. Thank you for your kind attention, and then I guess you'll have walking now, and then we'll be back here for another.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.